Hi, Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 61. Today, talking about the threshold of survival of early American architecture. So, despite the almost contemporary nature of early American architecture, from the perspective of British historians, whose eyes often blink with fatigue when they reach the 17th century, evidence from the field is beset by its own particular shortcomings. Foremost is the fact that what remains rarely reflects what existed 2 to 3 centuries ago. Fires, wars, and neglect have took their toll on built environment, but people were also active agents in reshaping their cities and farmsteads as they replaced old stock with more durable structures. Erecting cheaply constructed buildings, guaranteed not to last more than a few decades without substantial maintenance, became second nature to many colonists, who set as much store in moving as they lay in laying down deep roots in a particular locale. Many built to meet the needs of the moment rather than for posterity's sake. So as a result, the threshold of survival of many types of buildings in all parts of the country is extremely low. Unlike in many parts of southeastern England, here old buildings are not so thick on the ground in those areas settled by Europeans in the 17th and 18th centuries. Those that can be securely dated to the first half of the 17th century are quite rare. Far more common are houses that date from the late colonial period, though there are places like eastern North Carolina or Georgia where it is usual to find any buildings that represent the first 2 to 3 generations of settlement. So by contrast, in England, as many as 8,000 buildings dating before 1700 exist, in the comparatively small countryside of Suffolk alone. Close to a third of the Suffolk buildings listed in 1684, hearth tacks still stand, an ample legacy that scholars of early American architecture can also enjoy. If we compare those statistics to what we find, say, in the Chesapeake Bay area, for example, in America, we can only assume that a biblical plague swept nearly everything before it. It is a land with little to show for its first century of settlement. Only a handful of buildings can be dated to the last quarter of the 17th century, and none of those reflect what is typical of the period. New Englanders have always thought of themselves as blessed with scores of what Abbot Lowell Cummings once called first period houses, which were dwellings erected between the 1630s and roughly the first quarter of the 18th century. In the comparatively small and relatively densely settled region around Boston, every town has its oldest house said to date from that area of Puritan migration in the mid-17th century. These wooden houses with lobby entry plans, large central chimneys, stout decorated frames, and irregular fenestration have been much beloved by antiquarians, architects, and designers since the late 19th century. Yet how common were these buildings during that period? Though the Fairbanks House in Dedham has proved to be nearly as old as it has been claimed, a fresh look at documents, recent fieldwork, and dendrochronology have dispelled the myth that many first-generation houses, consigning their date of construction to the tail end of the first period in the early to mid-18th century. Yet other research suggests that two-story frame houses were a rarity in many parts of New England, making buildings such as the Whipple House in Ipswich less of an iconic summation of early New England architecture than has been assumed. Far humbler houses, most of which stood only a single story in height, were more pervasive in many parts of Massachusetts at the end of the 18th century. The tangible legacy of early buildings is even more tenuous south of New England. Nothing survives in the Hudson and Delaware valleys from the first Dutch and Swedish settlements, making it very difficult to assess the immediate impact of continental practices on early American architecture. 19th century sketches of Albany, for example, reveal just how much has been lost. James Eight's topographical drawings of towns show remnants of houses with narrow stepped gables. From the Hudson to the Delaware, elements of Dutch and German framing, plan types, and decorative aesthetics can be recognized in many surviving 18th century buildings. But there was also a large degree of intermingling of these groups that ultimately produced distinctive regional forms, not solely associated with ethnicity. How, for example, do you categorize Holy Trinity Church, built in Wilmington, Delaware in 1698? Also known as Old Swedes, it was built under the direction of Swedish Lutheran minister Erik Bork for a mixed congregation of English, Dutch, and Swedish worshippers. Bork contracted with John Smart and John Britt, two aptly named English carpenters who had migrated to Philadelphia to fabricate the bent principal rafter roofs used on the church. So missing from this early landscape are the thousands of rude log buildings erected by the first settlers of the Delaware Valley. Log construction consists of stacking round logs, partially hewn logs, or sawn planks on top of one another at 90-degree angles, and notching the overlapping corners to provide structural interlocking and integrity. The practice was unknown in England, but common in many parts of the German and Nordic-speaking lands of Central and Northern Central Europe. Scandinavian settlers introduced the method to America in the 1630s and 40s in the Delaware colony of New Sweden. Following the Scandinavians, German immigrants to Pennsylvania in the late 17th and early 18th centuries also brought log-building knowledge to the New World, and eventually to the backcountry of Maryland, Virginia, and the Carolinas. Its popularity was due to no small part to the vast, endless forests that provided timber for the taking. With a few tools and skills, colonists could erect rudimentary shelters, barns, and other buildings. Yet few of these early buildings survive, since they were replaced in kind by more substantial and well-crafted log, framed, and masonry structures. The absence of log buildings in areas not normally associated with it further distorts the history of early American architecture. Log buildings can be traced in Virginia as early as the 1650s, showing up on the eastern shore and south side at stone houses, dwellings, and jails. Anglo-American colonists in colonial or coastal Maryland and Virginia and northeastern Carolina borrowed this foreign technology from their European neighbors to the north as early as the 1650s. And by the first quarter of the 18th century, many parts of the region continued to be built this way. The colonists discovered that stacking logs had certain advantages over framing practices. As in frame construction, the degree of workmanship in log buildings varied considerably, ranging from well-fabricated plank buildings to crudely worked cabins. Plank structures with finely sawn logs and tightly fitted dovetail joints provided a measure of strength and security next to impossible in a frame building. The absence of gaps between the planks and the carefully interlocking corner joints familiar with those used in cabinetry made them ideal structures such as jails, smokehouses, and storehouses, where durability and interpenetrability were paramount. If plank buildings required investment in highly skilled labor, brown log construction reduced the involvement of craftsmen and specialized tools, making simply fashioned cabins the choice for those who wish to build a house on the frontier or a corn crib on a tobacco plantation. With the help of a few hands, a planter or homesteader could fell trees, lay them up with crudely notched corners, cut small holes for apertures, and cover the roof with riven slabs. In his survey of the dividing line between Virginia and North Carolina in 1728, William Byrd II of Westover found that most of the houses in this part of the country were log houses, covered with pine or cypress shingles, 3 feet long and one board. They are hung upon laths with pegs, and their doors, too, turn upon wooden hinges and have wooden locks to secure them, so that the building is finished without nails or other ironwork. Byrd's description implies that non-carpentered log buildings were present by the early 18th century on the fringes of the Chesapeake. So it is difficult to judge how pervasive the technology was for dwellings, service buildings, and agricultural structures in established areas. In one of the regions where archaeological investigations have been the most active, the evidence from evacuations over the past quarter century is quite ambiguous. Even better constructed log homes have hewn logs, carefully crafted joints, floor joists, and framed apertures which either sat directly on the ground or raised on wooden stumps, making them particularly evasive in an archaeological record. Many disappeared without leaving an impression in the ground. Documentary evidence is also very scarce for this period, with occasional references to log houses, but few detailed descriptions, unfortunately. So by the end of the 18th century, much of the Chesapeake, all of the backcountry, thanks to a large influx of Germans who came down the wagon road to Reading, Pennsylvania and Philadelphia, the settlements in the lower South and those in western Pennsylvania were filled with crudely fashioned log cabins, strongly built log dwellings, and carefully wrought plank smokehouses, stores, and jails. First and second generation immigrants from Ulster who settled in close proximity to the Germans in the backcountry also took up the construction practice, using technology alien to Ireland. But nearly all those early log buildings have totally disappeared without a trace. What survive are a few better crafted dwellings, a handful of churches, and hundreds of houses and farm buildings from the late 18th and early 19th century. Log houses with wooden chimneys were built well into the early 20th century in certain parts of the rural South and other impoverished regions where sharecroppers and tenants made do with buildings that had scarcely changed in two centuries. So since World War II, nearly all of these have vanished, completely replaced by modern housing, stock of mobile homes, and brick ranch houses. Greg Perry, the historic preservationist, signing out. Thanks for listening.